My name is Carol Avery, and talking a little bit about crafts and customs in Saudi Arabia today. Unfortunately, crafts alone, I maybe could talk 5 minutes on, because the Saudi culture really has diminished in its craft work. It's kind of sad, but there aren't too many things that you can go and buy anymore that are made in the country. Now that the money's available, they've gone to importing a lot of goodies and a lot of trinkets from overseas. And it's hard to find good, authentic things that are made in the country anymore. So not only was that a problem in trying to gather things up, we're always frustrated when we go gift shopping for people because we feel like we don't want to go and buy things from India and Pakistan to give as gifts. And it's usually what we end up doing because that's mostly what's available. But between that and the problem of just transporting items, I don't have a lot to demonstrate as far as showing you things, but I've got quite a bit to say, especially when it comes to customs, maybe more so than just the crafts. The first time I was really exposed to the crafts in Saudi Arabia was when I went to a it's an oasis town called Hofuf, about 80 miles from where we live. And it's really fun to go there because then you really feel like you're in Saudi Arabia to go to that town. It's very Arab. Not very many Westerners. I'm made to feel a little more conspicuous there. I'm always careful to dress very conservatively and to wear a scarf. But that's where the people come from the desert who still living in the desert to trade their wares and show what they have. So probably the first thing that you see that's sold in a lot of little stalls along the way are weavings. And they still do quite a bit of weaving. Weaving for mostly for wall hangings nowadays, but traditionally it was camel bags that they wove. And it's simply two bags that flop over the camel, so you've got pockets on either side. And they're woven in quite bright red and orange colors and different designs, a lot of diamond shape, diamond in the middle and then expanding outward that way. The Saudi women do the weaving, and they do it mostly just sitting on the ground without a typical loom, but just by running their yarn, whatever it may be. Camel hair is real popular, and they also have quite a few sheep and goats, so they use goat hair as well. And run long, long strands. It seems like most of what you see are panels, long strips that have been cut in pieces then. And they just sit on the ground, hold the end kind of tied around their waist, and work from that way forward with just a very simple heddle, nothing fancy whatsoever, just a basic weave. And their colors are quite bright, and I'm not sure, all I've been able to get from them is that they're natural dyes, and I'm not sure exactly, but they must be plants and roots, maybe bark from trees that they use for their dyeing. So the weaving is still done quite a bit, although I'm not an expert of enough weaver. Where I've bought a wall hanging I thought was Saudi and then had somebody come and say, oh, I see you have a wall hanging from Afghanistan. So I think a lot of them are made cheaply in other countries and just imported. And I'm not enough of an expert to be real bothered by that. But the people who really know their work are careful to be sure that what they get are the Bedouin weavings, Bedouin being the desert people. It's an interesting experience to buy wool. When you go to Hofuf, there's a women's area where it's all the women are just selling the things that they have made. And they'll sell balls of wool and camel's hair and goat hair. And the first time I went to Hofuf, I was rather overwhelmed. I'd only been in the country about a month. I wasn't really used to bargaining, and I wasn't used to a lot of things. And I walked into the women's area and was immediately surrounded by women holding this yarn right in my face and trying to tell me to buy theirs. And I was kind of overcome. I wasn't even going to buy any yarn. I had no use for yarn. So I just kind of stood there in awe, not knowing what to do. And not knowing what to say, I finally reached out and touched one of the balls of yarn and felt it. And then that was the real giveaway. That showed that I had interest. And then it was just like a swarm of bees around me. And I finally realized the only way I was going to get out of this was to buy some yarn. And so I finally, the woman whose yarn I think it was I touched, I just started bartering with her and discovered that bartering with women is a much harder procedure than with men. They did not want to come down in price at all, maybe because they had put all the hard work into it, and I didn't blame them, to tell the truth. So I got a good skein of yarn that probably would cost the equivalent of $6. I don't know enough about it. It's been years since I've done any weaving, and I still have done nothing with it. It's in my closet. In fact, I tried to find it to bring to show, and I couldn't find it, so I don't know. But I said I wanted to bring it with me, and I couldn't find it because I bought it 2 years ago now, and it's sitting in my closet somewhere. So, and I think it's camel hair. It's rather coarse. Usually in the weavings, they use a very coarse gray. Is it the warp? Warp that goes this way, right, that I think is camel's hair. And then the bright colors are the weft, going back and forth. That so you get a fringe at the bottom and the top with this very coarse gray, non-dyed hair. It used to be that the tents that they live in are woven. Now it seems like most of them are canvas that they must buy from somewhere. So the weavings that they do nowadays are more for hanging on the tent walls for decoration. And their tents are probably the typical, what you'd think of, kind of coming to a point and going out and then down four walls and have the big flaps that you can open up. We were fortunate enough last winter and going on a camping trip to be able to borrow a Bedouin tent. And it was obvious how well they're adapted to the sand and to the wind, even though ours did collapse in a windstorm. I think it was because we didn't know enough about how to put it up. Just four poles at the corner. Okay. And I'm trying to think. I think we had very, very long stakes that went down into the sand. That was a real problem, was how to anchor it in shifting sand. And I think we just didn't know enough about it to do it. And a center pole, right. There was one in the center. The thing that struck me was how warm that tent was with those heavy canvas walls. It was a cold, cold, windy night, and it ended up being a rainy night as well. And it was really very warm in there, which I thought, this is nice in the winter, but it also made me wonder, how do they stay cool in the summer? And I think that they just know how to position their tent so the prevailing winds will come through and open the draft, cool it off a bit. So weaving seemed to be one of the few crafts that remain, and like I said, it's so inundated with Afghani weavings that it's oftentimes hard to tell, and especially if you're not an expert, you may often be sold something, being told that it's a genuine Bedouin weaving, and then come across somebody who knows more about it, and they say, no, that's not true. So the other craft that is also kind of a dying industry, unfortunately, is silver and goldsmiths. And it's fun to watch them working. They work in very tiny, tiny little wooden huts. And you can watch them pounding their gold. The Saudi women often buy kind of a neck piece of pounded gold, with kind of a lot of spangles and coin-like pieces that are hanging down. Although I think that's more of a ceremonial. They'd wear it for a wedding or a big gathering. But the men, you can watch in there pounding their gold to make that jewelry. Most of the jewelry that we buy, though, that Westerners buy, are is made in Italy and shipped in. So it's no different than what you would probably buy around here, except that it's almost all 18 and 21 karat gold. So it's very fine gold, and it's beautiful jewelry. Most of it's imported. Quite a few women I know, though, have gone to goldsmiths to have custom-made jewelry made, and it's amazing the work that they do. A teacher that I worked with for a while had a beautiful ring with a big stone in it, and she had bought an opal of the same size on one of her journeys, and then went down to one of these goldsmiths, left her ring, and then left the opal and said, I want the very same ring, only with my opal in it, made. And she was a little nervous because he took the ring and the opal and dropped them in an envelope and said, okay, check back. You know, no receipt, no nothing. And she kept checking back and checking back, and he kept saying, it's coming, it's coming. And so at one point I talked to her and she said, I wonder if I've just lost it. But sure enough, about a week later she went and there he had it done, and it was just an exact replica of that original ring. It was beautiful. I wanted to ask her how much it cost, because not only was there a lot of gold in the ring, but I just wondered what he put into it. So there's still in every town are a few of these goldsmiths left that will do that kind of work, but theirs is also a dying breed. It's kind of a shame. You have to really look around to find these people. Baskets are still largely woven, and I just brought a very small sample. This is just one we have on our wall. But they're woven out of date palms. And to go to the market town of Hofuf, you see the women sitting there weaving these. Now, this is obviously just a wall hanging one, but they make huge, huge ones with handles for carrying and for baby baskets, too. And so we've kind of just bought a set of this style that some people use on their table for fruit and such, which we've just made a kind of decorative wall hanging with that. Nice, light, and inexpensive gifts to make. But I always enjoy going where I can watch them actually making the real thing, and that's one thing they still do quite a bit of. The women only I've seen do the weaving. Pottery is not a real prevalent craft, but also in the Oasis town, we visited a man who out in the country who does his own pottery, and it was quite something to see. He looked like he was really living in poverty, and I wondered if this was something he was forced to do or if it was really the life he chose. But he simply dug the clay out of the ground. He had a raft of little sons helping him. Must have been at least 10 little boys running around. So I would guess that he probably had more than one wife. And he had made his own little kiln, and he sat with his homemade wheel, and he just used the clay right from the ground and plopped it down and then made vases and different pieces of pottery, most of which was just sold to tourists like us. But it was fun to go and watch him make it and then be able to buy some of the trinkets. And what was kind of cute was that the little boys had all their own little things. They had made little camels out of clay and such. And they would always try to come and make a sale, get a little something out of you. Speaking of camels, reminds me, before I leave weaving, I should have mentioned that the women also do a lot with weaving harnesses for the camels. And also what's like an udder sack. They have a sack that goes, it's a strap around the back, and it fits over the camel's udder. And the reason for that is to prevent the calf from drinking all the milk, because the people wandering with these herds, they need that milk to survive too. And so they only let the calf get at the mother certain times during the day, and they make sure that they get their own out of there too, so they have their subsistence. So they actually have a woven sack that fits over her udder, and so they can control the nursing of the little one. So the women are in the town of Hofuf. There's a camel market, which is enjoyable to take the children to, where there are camels in a huge penned-off area, and men doing active trading and bargaining with their camels. And that's where the women are sitting then, selling their camel gear for the men to buy. So although camels don't have nearly the significance they used to, there's still, I think, a lot of people that have some wealth like to have a herd of camels. I think it's still a bit of a status thing, how many camels you have in your herd. So that craft is still revolves around that. The coffee pot here, this is a genuine one that is made in the town of Hofuf, and there are not very many of these left to be found. They have a certain seal on this, and I'll pass it around, which told us that it was made in there. This used to be, Hofuf used to be where all the coffee pots were made. And now, like I said, there's the vast majority are imported, very cheap brass coffee pots from Pakistan and the other countries. Some of the imported and more modern ones are very ornamental. They have little ornamental pieces dangling from the end of the spout here and from the handle, perhaps. This is also brass, but it's a very heavy one. I'll pass around so you can see it. One of the things we were told to look for in buying a coffee pot was to make sure that by holding it like this, that it held at a straight, at a vertical line like that. But that's supposed to be because it's weighted, the cover is weighted enough to make it do that. And we were told that that was one thing to look for in an authentic pot. I think it just facilitates the pouring of the coffee. So this is one that we bargained for, and I hope it's authentic. We've been told by everybody that it is. I haven't seen anybody make them, though. I don't think that there maybe is anybody left who makes them now. These are all pretty old, the ones that are left. So you have to do a little bit of searching in order to find them. But coffee, as I'll go into in a minute, is a real important part of their culture, much as with the Scandinavians, but in a different sense. I can't call it a craft, but also something that is very prevalent is the date industry, and about the only greenery you see in the country of any to any degree are date palm trees, and they grow in the oases, and it's always very refreshing to go and see them. Hi, Rachel. And it's really, it has such a heavy top. That's the thing that strikes me. Yeah, well, I'm going to give you a little sample here. Those of you who were brave enough to come indoors on a day like today. This is more of a souvenir package. I bought several of. In fact, I was real concerned when I flew into New York and had filled out a customs form there in big letters that said, you know, beware, do not bring any fresh fruits or vegetables into the country, and you had to declare if you had any. I thought, oh, so disappointed, because it was the last minute I remembered to go out and buy some. But I declared them, and they looked, and they said they were fine. I think because they were packaged, they worry more about things if you've gone out to a farmyard and picked the wild dates. I've heard that there are actually 70 different varieties of dates, and so the Saudis know what kind of dates are the best, what kind to buy. They're usually packaged packed very closely together, almost in one piece here. You can help yourself to a little piece. These, like I said, are more souvenir ones. You may have to kind of just break off a hunk. When I buy them I like to buy dates in Hofuf, because then I can buy a big 5-kilo bag, about 12 pounds, for $5 or $6. And it's a huge amount. And then I just freeze them and use them. 12 pounds. It's a big... A pound? Yeah, right. Right. Well, see, now this little box cost 80 cents just in itself, because it's more of a souvenir. Pardon?
The last time I was in Arizona, we paid $3.50 and $4.
A pound, right. 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 Yeah. That's a real advantage of, one of the advantages. We like dates and we love them. So I always try to go once or twice a year and get the big, big package and then have them to use. And after you freeze them, they get a little crystallized and crumbly, but they still work for cooking all right, for date breads and date bars, and for eating too, right? We don't complain too much, so. Yeah, they're pretty tasty. And that's still a real big industry in the country. It used to be that in the days of the desert people, that they pretty much lived on camel's milk and dates, and that was about it, because it was a perfect thing to haul with you. It had lots of energy, sugar energy in it, didn't spoil. They grow wherever you see an oasis. That's what you see are the date palms. So they'd carry them along and keep them So, jewelry, I was also going to say, I mentioned the gold and silver smiths. The kind of jewelry that you find in a trading town like Hofuf is it's quite old jewelry. They use a lot of silver beads, very big silver beads that are strung together, and often with pieces of amber in between, that I imagine they must have to trade for the amber, but you see quite a bit of it. Although the amber that I have from Denmark, the Scandinavian amber, at least what I have is a very polished, shiny look, whereas this is a real dull, yellowish kind of look. So I don't know if it's a different kind of amber or if it's just treated differently. But that's a very popular form of jewelry with the women. And also silver bracelets, silver rings. And to go to the women's souk, they'll almost literally pull you down to the ground and open up a wooden box that's full of old jewelry, some of it broken, some of it, you know, with stones in, some without. And again, I'm not enough of an expert where I feel comfortable in really bartering for a lot of it. But it's fun to go with somebody who really knows their jewelry and they can tell what's what. So that is probably the major crafts. Pull up a chair and have a date. We're sampling the men. No. At least I've never seen them with any. I don't think so. So then a little bit about customs. And the first place I think of starting is just in the home, especially since that's where most of their life revolves around, is around their home. The homes themselves, and I have what's actually a children's book here, but it's got a very excellent section in the back that explains a lot of different aspects of the Saudi lifestyle. And they show a floor plan in here of a typical Saudi home, which I thought was very good. From the outside, all you usually see is a wall. You can't see the house itself because they all have a wall, and then most of them have a garden within that wall, some trees, some flowers, kind of an area that they can walk in. So you always have to go through the gate, through the courtyard into the house itself. And then this is just a very simple floor plan, but it's quite realistic, really. When you come in the front door, it's the men's entrance, and the women's entrance is in the back of the house. And then this one shows two men's sitting rooms, majlis it's called. One with an eastern style would be more just cushions on the floor and then a cushion along the wall all the way around. And then in the western style would be sofas and rather plush ones, a lot of velvet, a lot of white velvet. The one men's sitting room which I've been in, which I told the story the other day about how I sort of accidentally got in there, it was very, very plush, all white velvet couches, all the same. And I just read in this book, in fact, that it said that is the custom to have all the furniture the same so that nobody will be above anybody else. Nobody will be seated at a different place. It's kind of their idea of hospitality, to treat everybody equally. Then the, unfortunately, the family room, which is the women's sitting room, at least in the case of the house I was in, was extremely sparse. It was only a carpeted floor, and just had cushions along the wall, not even on the floor. So you sat on the hard floor and just leaned up against a cushion. No furniture other than that. And there was an old television set on the floor in the corner. I don't know if it worked or not. So it was quite a discrepancy between the plush men's sitting room and the sparse women's one. And then the kitchen, naturally, is next to the women's sitting room, so they have easy access to that. And then there's usually an opening into the men's room where the men can be served. The meals are generally served on the floor on a rug, and everybody sits cross-legged around the rug.
But it would be taken into the men's room.
That's right. The women would take it in there and serve it to the man. Even a Western friend of mine whose husband had some Saudi students visit at their home. The men all stayed in the living room, and then she served the food as it was prepared to them. And that's pretty much the custom. Some of their customs at mealtime. One is that you are never, ever to use your left hand in eating, only the right hand. It's something that we haven't been in that many Saudi environments, but it's something we need to remind ourselves of, especially since a lot of times it's food that you grab, you know, that you just help yourself to remember not to use your left hand. The reason for that is the left hand is used exclusively for cleaning themselves when doing their toilet duties. And so that becomes the unclean hand. So they must make sure to only use your right hand in eating.
Don't they have any left-handed people?
Well, I guess not for eating they don't. No, that just simply wouldn't be allowed. And also in sitting on the floor, usually cross-legged, it would be very rude to have the soles of your feet pointing towards anybody. You're to make sure that your feet are tucked under you, away from other people. Which I guess they're used to sitting that way. I tell you, I couldn't last very long. The night I visited and sat on the floor for a couple hours, I was really squirming by the end. I felt quite uncomfortable, especially since we were sitting on the hard floor with just a cushion to lean against. But everybody else seemed very comfortable. If you're used to it, if that's the way you're raised, then that's fine. So nowadays, a lot of homes do serve food on plates with regular silverware like we would use. But hands are still used a lot. Every spring at graduation, the night before graduation, the university puts on a huge banquet for all the faculty and students, which, of course, women are not invited to, so I haven't experienced it. But my husband went a couple times. And we went up this spring, the day of it was going to be served, and he showed me how it was laid out up by the university classrooms. It was a huge courtyard area, all laid with carpet after carpet, so the entire thing was carpeted, and then cushions placed all around the area. And then in the middle is where they would bring, and then it was, the cushions were kind of in sections, and in the middle of each section then they would bring a roast lamb, which is a real common food, lamb, and they generally roast a whole lamb, and they stuff it with rice and nuts and herbs. So it's really quite tasty. But the only time I've been to a similar gathering, there was somebody there carving the meat and serving it on a platter. Whereas in the Saudi custom, the one that John went to, it was just grab and get what you want. So he said just to grab into this meat and pull it off was, to him, not overly appetizing. Everybody reaching in together and helping themselves. So it's what you're used to, of course, the custom. Other foods, like I said, lamb is a very popular one. I've never had cooked so much with lamb as I have over there, because it's one of the cheapest meats that we can get, and very tasty, very good. I think it just takes some getting used to how to prepare it. And I'm still learning. They also have a lot of spicy kind of vegetables and little pastries. Many of these actually originate in Lebanon, and there are a lot of Lebanese bakeries in our area where people go to buy delicacies for a dinner that they're serving. And I like them a lot. Many of them are very, very spicy, so I'm always a little hesitant to if it's too much for my tongue. Some other things that are mentioned in this book. Mashikusa is a zucchini squash. It's hollowed out and stuffed with ground meat, and that's very good, sometimes with rice too. I like that a lot. And they can have the same thing stuffed with tomatoes. Their salads are very popular, lettuce and tomato salads. Something called tabbouleh, which I think is also Lebanese. It's ground parsley, and it takes a lot of parsley to make, and then has onions and, again, a lot of spices in it. It's a very popular kind of salad.
That would be Saudi?
Well, they serve it, I think it's actually Lebanese, but it's served a lot in our area, so I think maybe the Saudis have taken it over, too, as one of their traditional dishes. But it's very common to have. I think of this banquet that our women's group had at the end of the year that was catered, and so it was all traditional native food, and there was a lot of that type. Some very, very spicy. sambusa is a pastry, a very nice flaky pastry that's stuffed with either meat or with vegetables, usually some kind of ground meat, also often very spicy. And always their Arab bread, that's the basis of every meal, which is pocket bread like we can buy nowadays, pita bread. And it's served with hummus, which is ground garbanzo beans, cooked and ground with lemon juice added and onion added. And it's really very tasty. You dip your, break off a piece of pocket bread and dip it in the hummus and eat that. That also is a Lebanese extraction, I think. So there aren't too many foods that I think of as being genuinely Saudi except for lamb and rice. It seemed to be the two real staples of theirs. And then most of these other dishes they've sort of imported from other Arab countries. Great stuffed grape leaves are real popular. It's something you get a lot in Greece and in the other Arab countries, which I find very tasty. Yeah, you eat the leaf and everything. No, you eat the whole thing, usually stuffed with ground meat too. And it tastes a lot like olives to me, I think. The grape leaf is kind of a strong taste, but I like it a lot. And they import a lot of olives, also, again, I think from Lebanon and Turkey. And I've never seen any olive groves in the country. I think it's too hot and dry there. But they use a lot of them, a lot. I'm always embarrassed because there's one Lebanese delicatessen I love going in, and they've got a whole series. Well, I mean, dates is really the one natural produce that grows. But they've done so much experimenting now with growing their own, even their own wheat, where they do have their own flour mill. And you can get local vegetables, carrots and tomatoes and such. I've never seen where it is that they grow them, and I often wonder what it looks like, what the area looks like where they are grown. But they're, because the country is trying to become more and more self-sufficient, away from needing other countries and their produce so much. They've done a lot to try to do their own thing, but they have a long ways to go simply because of the climate, you know, and the sand. It's not even the sand so much as the lack of water. We found that once we can get water to an area, things will grow pretty well, especially with all the sunshine. Right, yes.
Sweet sand.
That's right.
That was really interesting.
Yeah, that's something we like to tell people. Yeah. Apparently, Saudi Arabia is one of the biggest importers of sand in the world because their sand is too salty to use for planting vegetables and also for making concrete. They need a different kind of sand. And everything practically is in concrete there, all the buildings. So apparently they import it by the shiploads through the Red Sea.
That's
seems
strange.
Very strange. I know. Like bringing coals to Newcastle, kind of thing. Dresses I've gone into a little bit, because I wore one the other day. Around the home, the women wear pretty much just long, simple cotton dresses. And I really find the cotton dresses to be quite cool in the hot weather. I like, the long sleeves can bother me sometimes, especially if they're tight around my wrist. But just to have a long, flowing kind of cotton dress is really very cool in the hot weather. The problem with them is that that's indoors that they wear those cotton dresses, and then of course when they're outdoors, they're covered. So I brought our Saudi costumes here, which all of you, if you came to the forum the other night, have already seen. But the men must be easy to shop for because there's a one and only one thing that they wear, and that is their thobe.
There's no problem with changing style.
No problem with changing style. Nope. The only problem is keeping them clean because it's so dusty. But just as simple, almost looks like a dress. And again, very cool. I think they would be rather comfortable to wear in the hot weather. In the wintertime, they wear them in brown and gray. But most of the year, you see them in white.
And what do they wear under those curls? It's just underwear?
Just, I think, like white boxer short types things.
All right.
And probably long ones in the wintertime when it's cold. And I think an undershirt, too, which you kind of need when you wear something white. Mm-hmm. Now, John went to a tailor to have this made, which most of them do. You don't just go to a thobe shop and find your size. But he went to the tailor and was measured, and then it was sewn for him. there are a lot of women's tailors too. I've never gone to one myself, but a lot of my friends do, and they'll go and just bring a dress they like or a picture out of a magazine of a dress they like and bring the material, and a week later it's completely sewn for them, and a beautiful job. One lady was just telling me she had a pantsuit made and she paid $20 on top of the material. She provided the material and then she paid $20, which, yes, I thought that was pretty well done for a custom made suit. I have yet to go and I really should try it. So John, this was his first experience with a tailor, of just going in and being measured and then having it sewn.
Does he have a use for that material?
No. Not really.
Okay.
Maybe to wear around the house for a house coat, but
okay.
He's never worn one on at school. He actually dresses quite casually for school. You know, just nice pants and a shirt, but he doesn't dress in a suit coat and such. And then their gutra, this we actually used for a tablecloth for a long time. I thought it was very nice.
They came from Israel.
Uh-huh, right. And these are, you know, when you're in a sandstorm, which to me is the ultimate misery. I've been through blizzards and everything. But a sandstorm, which is called a shamal, is just terrible. The dusty sand blowing everywhere. And of course, the men wearing these gutras can just wrap it around their face, and they're protected. And that's, of course, the reason why they did it. You know, they wrap it like that and up around their face, just with their eyes peeking out. So when it comes to the men, everything seems to make a lot of sense. Seems to be very, you know, cool and comfortable, and in this case, easy to protect them. Underneath the gutra, they wear this, which is really like a Jewish skull cap. And the thing that strikes us a lot for how much the Saudis despise the Jews and refuse to even admit that Israel exists, still their background is similar enough where there are so many similarities between them. And the first time I saw one of these, I was really surprised because I was familiar with a Jewish skull cap and never realized that this is what the Saudis wear too. So they always wear one of these under their gutra. Sometimes in a shop in town, somewhere indoors, they may only have this on. And little boys wear these a lot. I think on the front of my picture, yeah, there's a picture of a little guy there with his on. That's something, see if it says, it doesn't say where it was made. Or if it does, it's in Arabic, so I don't know what it says. And then they have these rings that they wear on top of their gutra that just kind of holds it in place on their head. These can be very ornamental when it comes to kings and princes, and they can be white and red and three-tiered. It's just, I'll pass around. It's just fabric, I think. It's like a heavy twine almost that's wrapped around there. Oh, is that ever funny? I didn't notice that before. This is the box that it came in, something in Arabic with a deer. Underneath it says, snack pot beef chow mein. Makes me wonder where the box came from. Looks like it's a recycled.
I was just going to say, they've reused.
Snack pot beef chow mein, ready meal with chopped and shaped beef. So they must have collected old boxes to make like a heavy rope. It kind of keeps the gutra in place. So the men, like I said, have it easy. And then the poor women, I mean, it's obvious why they don't get out of the house much, and it's because, especially in the hot weather, it must be absolutely unbearable to wear their abayas. Most all of them are nylon. You can also find silk ones, which I've been tempted to buy one because they're really quite pretty. They have a lot of a lace work around the edges and such. But they may cost $80 or so for one. And
nylon is a terrible material.
So hot. So hot. I honestly don't know how they survive. Just the 5 or 10 minutes the other evening when I had this on and was trying to talk, it was just like I couldn't breathe, you know, having your face covered up. And this veil I bought in Hofuf, and some of these little dangly things have come off. And most of the women in Hofuf wear these. The different areas, the women have a lot of different kind of veils. And some they even have what comes out like a beak. I think it's a kind of cardboard. It's a real strange-looking head covering over in the western part of the country. Apparently they wear these. And in some of the other Arab countries, they wear that kind. But I think at least the women in Hofuf are smart enough to have so that their eyes can show through. The women around where we are all have just their head completely covered with this kind of a cloth, which I think must be so stifling, not only to try to breathe through, but try to see through.
Does it ever get cool there?
The winters do, yes. And that's one time I think that the women have it made is in January on a cold, windy day. They're kind of wrapped up in their black and aren't freezing like the rest of us. But in January, we need sweaters and jackets on, and if it rains once in a while. So they just have their head completely covered like this, and you can see so little through one of these. That's one thing in the book I mentioned before, At the Drop of the Veil, where the Western woman married a Saudi. And that was the thing that really struck her, was just how hard it was to see to move, to get around. She talked about trying to walk up and down narrow little flights of stairs, which was hard enough, fighting with this cloak all around her. And then to be behind this black and to try to see was about impossible.
So,
puberty, so probably 12, 13, somewhere in there. I don't know if there's an exact age that they, or if it's just somewhere in there. So the women in Hofuf would wear this first over their face and then cover the rest of their head with this kind of black fabric. And then the abaya just fits over your head and then wraps around. Actually, it's kind of thin, but it is so beastly hot. So it fits around like that. And then all that's left to stick out are your hands. And to watch women carrying babies and having kids in tow, and I mean, they do it very gracefully. I'm sure it must be something you just get used to. But I would find it so very awkward.
You
to get around like that. No, you just it's just room for your hands is all. And of course my face would be completely covered here too, so that's all you see. You know, just completely black. And in the hot weather, I just don't know how they do it, I really don't. And they mostly do get out in the evening, but even the evenings can be really quite warm and humid. So I guess it's only a matter of training, what you get used to, that you put up with. I would think even if it were white, it wouldn't be so bad. But black is kind of the ultimate. One thing the women do a lot of, they use something called henna, which I believe is made from the bark of a tree. It comes from a tree, either the root or the bark. And it they use it in their hair, and they use it on their fingernails. And it's a reddish color. And that's quite stylish, is to henna your fingernails. And apparently it's supposed to be very good for your hair. I have quite a few friends who've hennaed their hair. You can also get black henna, black and red henna. So, but a lot of the then very black-haired Saudi women have a lot of red in their hair because of this henna. In Hofuf, some of the men, I think it's more the religious men, will henna their beards, so they have very bright red beards. And they will henna their donkeys too, which is a funny looking sight. Their donkeys have this red tinge all over their body. I don't know in the case of a donkey, I think they probably just rub it on. But when it comes to having your hair hennaed, it's a procedure of cooking it, I think, and then applying it to your hair and letting it sit and rinse it out. And a good friend of mine, a British friend of mine, wanted to henna her hair because she's so worried she's turning gray, and she had some black henna. But she had not too long before that dyed her hair with a traditional dye. And the two combined to make a greenish tinge in her hair, and she was just so upset about what to do about this green look to her hair, and there was really nothing she could do except let it. So the two sort of worked together. But they say it's very good for your hair. I never needed or wanted to try it myself. But let's see. Customs at home? I've never seen any in town. We have one at the university that we go to. In fact, I go just to a lady who's a beautician and does the work right in her own home, just in her bathroom. She gives permanents and does haircuts. She's a British gal. I've never seen any in town. I think they all pretty much have just long, long black, straight black hair and don't do much else with it other than to hem it. And they pretty much do that just with each other in their home. Something about coffee, because that's such an important part of their culture. This is a typical, but not a, this would be just an everyday coffee cup. This is the biggest one I've ever seen. So they come in this size and smaller, which I think the Scandinavians would be an uproar over. I certainly am. But this is generally how it's served. And anytime you're in town, you will always see people bringing a tray of these coffee cups in to the people in the stores to have their little coffee break. This is a glass one. But the ones you would have around your home for company, especially the kinds I've seen, don't have a handle. They're a little bit smaller, and then usually decorated. Porcelain or glass, right? And more decorative than this one. So they make their coffee, and I had a lesson once, and I've never tried it myself. I don't mind it too much. My husband doesn't care for their coffee much because it's made with cardamom, and it's got quite a strong taste to it. But to make a pot of coffee like this, they would probably use about this much coffee grounds and then the remaining amount of water, and just let it boil on the stove. And it's a special coffee bean that they roast, a green coffee bean they roast and grind. And they just let it boil, and they bring it to a boil about three times. It boils, and they take it off and let the foam kind of die away and do that three times. And then they add their ground cardamom to that. So the cardamom is a very strong flavor in the coffee. And so after they've boiled that again, then they put it in the coffee pot and let it sit for a while. Then they have sort of a fibrous material. I'm not sure if it comes... It looks like the fiber that would be on the outside of a coconut, and I'm not sure where they get it from. But they just stuff it in the spout here so that when they pour their coffee, the grounds won't get in it. And it's kind of a nice little filter. So it's kind of a ritual of making the coffee, and it's a ritual of serving the coffee. It used to be that the youngest of the adults was always in charge of making the coffee. That was a way of respecting his elders. And they pour it in where they'll hold it almost up like this, and it just shoots down in a little stream, and they have a way of just aiming, or they'll start here and pull it up. That's right. And it's really something to watch. It's quite an art. It takes a lot of practice, I'm sure. And then as they go around and serve their guests, they stay right with one guest until they've had enough coffee. So they may fill your cup three or four times. And then the way that you indicate that you're done is just by shaking your cup like this. And then they'll move on to the next person. So. No, it's just, but it looks almost more like tea. It's a very thin, kind of greenish look to it, greenish-brown look. I don't mind it too much. My husband really doesn't care for it at all, but I've had it several times. And the only time that I've really had it is the director of the English program at the university, once or twice a year, has a huge banquet for all the English teachers and their wives, which... it wouldn't happen in a normal Saudi situation that they would have us mixed company, but they have it outdoors in the backyard of a house, and we all mingle together. And there, you just have somebody going around pouring everybody's cup. They don't sit and wait for you to finish, but in a traditional Saudi setting, they would. So it's important that you know this sign of no, you know, please no more, because they would stand there all day and continue filling your cup while the other peoples are waiting until you indicate to them that you've had enough. And I think generally three or four cups are what a person would have, and then they would indicate, now I've had enough, and then they move on to the next person. So it's a real art, and it's a real part of their tradition of after a meal, then right away they would bring out coffee. And then lots of times tea after that. They have a very sweet kind of tea, and I'm not even sure how they make that. But that would even follow after the coffee. So it's all quite of a ritual that they follow, that they go by. So it's kind of fun. I was just, as I was going through my wallet, I found a 10 real note here I was going to pass around. This is a typical bill. It has this palm trees on the one side. Palm trees are kind of their national symbol. They have a symbol of two palm trees with crossed swords in front of, a palm tree with two crossed swords in front of it. And that's to indicate the heritage of their country has developed much around the date palm tree. And then the swords indicate the fighting that had to go on in order for King Abdulaziz to take over the country about 100 years ago. One real is worth about, goodness, now it's only worth about 25 cents. So this 10 reals would be about $2.50. One thing that's happening right now, because the country is losing money, is they've devalued the real, which means that we get fewer dollars for our real. So we're actually making less money as time goes on because the real keeps seeming to devalue. And it's something we need to take into consideration next year when it's time to sign another contract, is whether or not it's going to pay. Because it's like for every raise we get, the real devalues that much more, and we end up with, you know, less or haven't gained anything. And then the present king, King Fahad's picture is on the front. And then this is their holy, called the Kaaba, that is in their holy city of Mecca. And it's once a year for the Hajj that the Saudis, once in their lifetime, are supposed to go to Mecca and do this these certain rites at the Kaaba. They have to circle it seven times, and they have to say certain things. And every Muslim, no matter where they live, is expected to do that once in their lifetimes.
How did this guy get to this thing? He was something like a tribal leader in the desert before, or what?
The original king, Abdulaziz, was, yes, and he had to... He was a very crafty man, and he had to do a lot of manipulating and a lot of brutal fighting to take over the country. And then, since he died, he designated that it would be his sons who took over his reign. His sons, and he has like 46 of them. He had many wives. And so even though he died in the 50s, I believe, this is still another son, and there are many more to follow. Now, I don't know what will ever happen. Eventually, they are going to get to the end of that that line of sons. And some have chosen not to take over. It was to go to the oldest son and then on down. And some, for different reasons, have gotten involved in business and such. So this is King Fahad, who's the king now. There was King Saud, was his first son, that took over after he died. And he was really not a very good leader at all. He spent money like just like nothing. And a lot of it was in a very generous way. He apparently just handed money to people right and left. But he got the country in a real stickler of a problem for finances. And then King Faisal was probably the best one that came after King Saud. And he was assassinated by a nephew in the 70s. But King Faisal was one who was king when all the oil business of the 70s was going on. He's the one that upped the oil prices tremendously when there was an oil shortage, which he really had every right to do. The Western world was taking such advantage of their country by only having oil cost a few dollars a barrel and not letting it rise above that when actually it is their oil. So then he was assassinated, and then there was... He had a brother and who has died, and now King Fahad is the king. He always looks very poorly on TV, and you wonder how long he's going to be around. And the concern is that the crown prince, the next brother in line, seems to be kind of a fanatic who probably would want to go back to the traditional ways even more so, to try to get rid of some of the technology and some of the Westerners. So could be a changed world. Just a couple more minutes, and let me see if there's anything else I can bring up.
Does all the money have one side in English?
Yes, it does now. Yeah, it's all Arabic on one side and English on the other. That's kind of gotten to be their second language. Being such a technological country, they didn't really have any.
Is that a recent
shorts? Oh, I think, well, recent maybe, meaning the past 20 years,
oh,
it has been. There was one picture. This is actually the yearbook from the school where I teach that came out this year. And it's kind of interesting because they've, although most of it is just pictures of the children in school, they've gone into town and they've taken pictures. And this is one thing people who know about doors, which I know absolutely nothing about, apparently that there are doors that are very ornamental and very old that you could even buy now that have been taken off of old countries. But this is a typical gold market or gold souk where you go in and the walls are literally dripping in gold, and it's always a lot of fun to go in there. Just the glitter is really something. Lots of times it's all right out in the open. And most of it is just the children in the school, which at the beginning it lists the nationalities represented, and I think it's about 40 nationalities that are represented in the school. Here are some typical scenes. Here's a man here harvesting his dates. Has a way of climbing the date tree with kind of a belt around his back, and then just takes a knife and chops them off.
And they drop.
And they drop, right. And there's a certain time, certain period of ripeness where they know how to get them. And not an unfamiliar scene are camels, even as much as it's pretty built up around where we live. It's quite frequent when we drive to the beach that we'll come across a herd of camels and we have to stop the car to let them go across the road. And the girls always get real excited when they see that. So they're still pretty prevalent in the country, though not nearly to the extent that they used to be.
So you'd have to go outside of your city where you live.
Yeah, although about a month ago, I'm home, coming home from the bus one day, right on the university campus, here came a man with his camel. I don't know where he came from or where he was going to, but he was just wandering around the road. And this is just a real common sign that we see, closed for prayer time, and that's what everybody puts their sign out when it's prayer time, and the shop is closed down, and it means come back another time, wait 20 minutes, and we'll open up again.
Is that how long
for a time? It varies. Some are shorter, some are a little bit longer, some are over half an hour, but 20 minutes is sort of the average.
The time of day?
That's right. There's one at... That's right. There's one that comes at dawn. Dawn being even before sunrise, which is anywhere between 4:30 and 5:30 in the morning, depending on the time of year. And that's when prayer call comes. I had a tape of prayer call. I'll have to bring another time. The problem is that there's the mosque on our campus is maybe almost a mile away. And in the fall, we don't even hear it because the prevailing winds are blowing in the opposite direction. But in the winter time, when they're blowing towards us, that 4:30 prayer call is just as if somebody's got a huge loudspeaker right outside our bedroom door and blasting it in. So we don't appreciate it too much. Our daughter was getting where she was waking up to 5 o'clock prayer call for a while this winter, and I was thinking, oh, I don't know if I could take this much longer.